Simba, I am your father.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to the third special episode of Remakers Mark. Today, in this special episode, we are going to be talking about best Hollywood casting choices. So those casting choices that we feel are indelible, are unchangeable, those things that we couldn't possibly see another actor or actress in that role because it was picked so perfectly the first time. This came about because of a Twitter discussion with some special guests that we have here tonight. So this is also the first time that we have guests on Remakers Mark, which we're very excited about, and I will introduce them shortly. When the first trailer for the new The Wolverine movie came out, it brought on a nice Twitter reaction in general, but specifically with a few of our guests here, basically saying how spot on that particular choice was in terms of Hugh Jackman being cast as Wolverine. And then we had a few back and forths and some great discussion. And as a result of that, we basically decided, wow, this would be a really cool Remakers Mark discussion. So here we are today. It also got us talking about what good casting means and what the best examples of good casting are. So that's what we're going to talk a lot about today. And then one of our guests, Josh, who we will introduce here shortly, brought up a really great point, which is that, so much of casting is about the role itself, but finding the balance between the role as written and the actor who is portraying the role and finding the balance of that. You know, sometimes someone just inhabits the role so much that it is, you know, more a balance of the actor versus the role. So we're going to touch on that as well. So that's what today's discussion is going to be all about. So we're really excited to get things going here. As usual, we have some of our standard stalwart Remakers Mark here. So we have Andy Wicks, Jeremy Nilsson, and Lee Halfjump with us here. So we're really excited to have you guys here as always. Thank you. We want to say congratulations. Last special episode, we mentioned that our Remakers Mark colleague Mark was expecting a baby, and they had the baby and all is well, and the baby is beautiful, and so we're super happy for Mark and his family. So that is wonderful. So he can't be here tonight because he's being a dad, and that's awesome. So the special guests, again, this is the first time we're having guests on Remakers Mark, which we're super excited about. So the first one is Josh Freeman. Josh, why don't you talk a little bit about yourself, and then if you could also say, what was the first movie that you remember seeing in the theater?
Hey folks, Josh Freeman here. Thanks, Kyle, so much for letting me join this illustrious crew of madmen that we've got. First movie that I can remember seeing as a child was Return of the Jedi. And I'll never forget it because my father came and picked me up from daycare early and said, hey, we're going to see a movie. And I was so excited. I'm like, what are we going to see? What are we going to see? And he said, it's a surprise. And next thing you know, we're sitting in the movie theater and Star Wars pops out and it's Return of the Jedi, which incidentally still to this day, and I'll get crap over this, is my favorite Star Wars movie of all time. So there you go.
Nothing wrong with that.
You won't get crap from me because it's one of my favorites.
Dad of the year right there.
Yeah, no doubt. Lee and I have had that discussion about what our favorite Star Wars movies, and I think you would call it, you call Return your favorite Star Wars, right, Lee?
I did, just because I like how it wraps up the whole saga.
Yep, I think that's right on. Yeah, it's I have this theory that for example, like, oh gosh, who's the director? Guy... he's British.
Richie.
Lockstock. Guy Ritchie, thank you. So many people don't know whether they like Lockstock and Two Smoking Barrels or A Snatch better, and my theory is that it's whichever one you saw first, because they're so similar and because they share so many things. So I wonder if that's kind of that same thing where it's like, you know, that just informed what sci-fi was for you.
Correct.
Yeah. Right on. So next is Kate O'Reilly, our first female representation here at Remakers Mark, which we're very happy about. Kate, tell us about yourself and then what the first movie you saw in the theater was.
I'm Kate O'Reilly, and the first movie I saw in the theater was A Christmas Story.
No way.
Yep.
Excellent.
Yep. And my dad took me. It was a special, like, father-daughter, you know, night out, and we went, and I remember loving it and not understanding how it was based in the past, or really couldn't like understand that quite yet. So, sure. But I loved it. Yeah, we had a great time.
Funny. Yeah, you don't think about those things. That's really a specific memory. I like that. Interesting. All right. And last but not least is Pete Bastian. Pete, tell us about yourself and the first movie you remember seeing in the theater. And you better tell the truth, you son of a fool.
Hello, Internet. My first impression is to say, I'm Pete Bastian, first of all. My first impression is to say that the movie I remember is Aladdin, but that is a bald-faced lie because the first movie I saw in the theater, or at least that I remember seeing in the theater, is Disney The Little Mermaid.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which ain't no shame there.
Yeah, it nicely informs my A, undying love of redheads, and B, never-ending fear of barracudas. Terrifying.
Well, how do you feel about the song Barracuda by Heart?
Ooh.
Too catchy to be scared of.
Ariel is going to forever be the second best Disney princess.
Wish I could be part of your world.
Little known fact, wow. Ariel was voiced by Jeremy.
That was not me singing.
Still
lovely singing
weird.
Voice.
That was not me.
Nice. So normal remakers, Marks, are you prepared to say what your first movie in the theaters were if we go around the horn here?
I am.
Oh, yes.
All right. Andy, what about you?
My first one that I remember was also Return of the Jedi. And what I remember most about the experience more than the movie was the fact that there was a very severe thunderstorm going on right outside the theater. And they had to delay the showing of it for about 15 minutes, I think. The manager of the theater came in and told everyone, we have to wait for the storm to go by, blah, blah, blah. And I remember thinking, this is a very weird experience. Like, is this what all movies are like? I didn't understand that this was not normal. I was not a smart child. But, yeah.
Funny.
Return of the Jedi. I was 5.
One of the more amazing film-going experiences I had, and it wasn't because of the movie, but I saw Twister in the theater in Brainerd, and the weather outside at the time was just like it was a tornado warning. So, like, we came into the theater at a tornado warning, and then the movie Twister happened, and, like, I mean, the movie was pretty loud, but we could hear the weather outside. Wow. So, you know, yay soundproofing in Brainerd theaters. But, you know, I mean, it was just like it was this all-encompassing, enriching experience. So, yeah, I hear that.
It was more than 3D.
It was more, exactly. It was like 6D. So Jeremy Nilsson, what was your first movie in the theater?
So before that, so when the scene in Twister, when they were at the drive-in watching a movie about Twisters, and you were watching a movie about Twisters, while there was a Twister, that was the most meta you've ever been in your whole life.
It's true.
It's true.
My first movie was actually Star Wars. Just Star
that's,
Wars.
Okay. That's hardcore.
I feel like I've told this story on the podcast before, but yeah.
Yeah, it sounds vaguely familiar.
I was down in the cities as a young child visiting my aunt while my mom went to some sort of seminar or something, and she took me to Star Wars, and I remember being freaked out by the little thing in the garbage compactor.
Nice.
We were all freaked out by that, though.
No, nerd moment. That's called the Dianoga. Dianoga.
Nice.
Wow. Good work. Good nerd Excellent. Moment. All right. And Lee, what was your first movie in the theater?
I don't know if it was the actual first movie I ever saw, but it's the first one I remember. And it was Popeye with Robin Williams.
Wow.
If anybody remembers that.
The Robert Altman.
Epic like, movie. Epic like, movie.
Yeah, like 1981 or something like that.
No.
I just got over my fear of octopuses from seeing that. I literally, like last year.
Octopi?
Shelley Long. Shelley yes. Long.
Was it Shelley Long? Long? No, it was Shelley Duvall.
Shelley Duvall. Yes. Good call.
And then she,
love
and
that
then
movie.
She, yeah, and then she went on to do The Shining.
Yep, that is correct.
Indeed.
Nice. And as for me, I think, I'm not 100% sure of this, but I think the first movie I ever saw in the theater was E.T. And I just looked it up and that was 1982, so it would have been 4. So I'm wondering if it was a re-release, maybe? I don't know.
It was. That's
feasible.
It was re-released a few years later.
Okay. That seems more likely to me. The most indelible movie memory in my mind was the my 5th grade birthday party when I had like a bunch of friends and we did the McDonald's birthday and then we went and saw Spaceballs, which was just like I will never ever forget that day.
Best birthday ever.
Seriously, one of the best days ever in the history of Dells. So, yeah, that was pretty fantastic.
May the Schwartz be with you.
Yeah, and also with you. Oh wait, I jumped in early. Sorry. So now you've got an idea about who we are and what we're into. Obviously, we're a good nerdy crew here. So we're going to go down the line here. I've alternated who is speaking when. So we're going to do a old Remakers marker and then a new Remakers marker, a guest host. So I'm going to go first with my pick for best Hollywood casting choice. And when I was thinking about this, I touched on this a little bit. My idea was that I wanted my pick to be someone who I couldn't imagine anyone else in that role, that there's no way that anybody could do that role justice. In fact, I would rebel against them changing that to recast it with someone. So, you know, the last special episode we talked about untouchable movies. To me, this is almost like untouchable roles, in that I would not want anyone else to do this role because I don't think they could do it as well or even do a version of that. So the role that I went with was, and I'm probably going to butcher the last name, but it's a little bit outside of the Hollywood realm, but it's Audrey Toto from Amelie.
Isn't it Tattoo? You
know, oh.
Tattoo?
I think. I don't know.
I don't recall. I don't speak German. It's
Utini.
Yes. Audrey Utini. Yes, exactly. You know, coming out of that, that entire movie is on her shoulders. Mm-hmm. And I didn't really know her much before that. And I, you know, I've certainly seen a lot of things with her since then. But I mean, she completely carried that movie. And if it were not for her, that movie would not have succeeded. I wouldn't say at all. I mean, it's, you know, Jeunet is a great director. He's very visual. But everything hinges upon your believing that she is who she is and that she does what she does and that she feels and acts the way she does. You know, quirk can be so hard to do well, that when you do it very well, it is hugely powerful. And I think that is what I saw in this role, is that she was not only quirky, she was interesting. You cared for her. You wanted her to find the man in the photo booth. I mean, you had all these things that you were rooting for her. And a lot of that is great direction, but so much of that is just in her performance. So I don't think Amelie would be remakeable. I think that would be pretty darn tough. But I truly don't think that anyone could have done what she did in that role. So Audrey Tautar in Amelie. Audrey Tautar, yes. So thoughts on that?
I agree with you, Dells, that that she did the what did you use? Quirky? Was that the phrase that she used, the term?
Yeah, that can be a little pejorative, but I don't mean for it to be.
But I know what you mean by that, and I agree she did a fantastic job. I disagree with you slightly on that she carried the entire movie, because I think that the rest of the supporting cast was also very, very good in their own way, and I think they supported her very well and allowed her to do a lot of what she did that made that role shine so much. I don't see that the rest of the movie kind of stinking with her shining so brightly. I think that there was a lot of the movie it's one of my top five favorite movies of all time.
Me too.
And I think that it's very solid from front to back, but I agree that she in that role would likely be irreplaceable.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I agree with you, but I don't think, I think if her foundation was not there, the movie would not have been it would have been like a 6 out of 10, not a 9 out of 10. You know, I mean, I think when you have a main character that you need to, it's true. You've seen my website, mathishard.net, shameless plug. Yay. So, you know, I think that I agree with you, but I just don't think the movie would have succeeded as it did were it not for her performance in a big, big way.
I'll give you that.
Other thoughts at all?
I feel like I don't know French actresses enough to really like speak on the subject, but I guess I could throw this out here. Could you see an actress of any other nationality playing that role?
It's a very French movie, so I think if you tried to remake it and you redid everything in a different culture, a different environment, a different world, I think potentially you could do so, but I think I can't see any particular French actresses, and again, I'm not terribly versed on that as well, but yeah, I mean, I think if I were to see it being done, it would have to be that they changed everything with that, so that would be the only way I could see it, and then recast someone, you know, of the same ilk in that culture, maybe. But I don't know who that would be.
I think you'd have to remake the movie as not a French movie to find an actress who would be able to do what she did.
Well, that's a point right there. Is French movies would be really hard to remake outside of French actors and French storylines. Le Pacte de la Houe, aka Brotherhood of the Wolf, great example.
how can you go back and remake that outside of the French piece, even though they used mostly American actors and some French, but the entire story writing is so different.
That was a great movie, by the way.
Yeah, good call.
I mean,
if you think of it being made here, it would be just so sticky sweet. I mean, she really got away with a lot because it was in French, and I think it went over so well with American audiences because we don't know the influx and we don't know the language and we don't know the set, the scenery and everything.
I picture every American audience that saw that movie looking like the audience in the movie theater in the movie when she's talking about looking back, you know, at the audience. That's how I pictured every American audience watching it, just kind of going, oh.
Yeah, that is spot on.
Well, this makes me wonder what you guys think of like Swedish remakes, like the girl, like Fincher's Girl with the Dragon Tattoo remake, where it's like clearly just blatantly trying to ape the Swedish style. Like, do you think that worked? It seems, I don't know.
I think that worked in a big way because I think that is, well, largely because the original was so true to a source material that was already there. I don't think Amelie was a book. I could be gravely mistaken there, but you know, there was already a reference to fall back on. And the Swedish movies, I thought, captured that quite well. In fact, I think they were better than the books, personally. But I think Fincher basically, you know, had that template, had the original template to fall back on, but also had the Swedish movie to fall back on. So I thought he did his job in terms of separating it stylistically, mostly. But I think story-wise, mood-wise, tone-wise, I think he was more falling back on the book than on the Swedish films.
Hmm. I would agree.
I've only seen the Swedish version, so I like those so much that I kind of don't want to see the American remakes.
The American one, it's worth seeing. The American one was better than I was expecting it to be because, like you, Jer, I absolutely loved the Swedish version of Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. And I think the books, I would disagree with you, Kyle, that I think the books are better than the movies, but I still think the movies are fantastic. Yeah, I don't know. That's a tough one. I'm curious to see how the rest of that series plays out. I think they did a good job with casting. I was leery when Daniel Craig was announced because I thought they were going to try to make that character a James Bond character, but they really didn't, which I was glad that they opted not to. And I think Lisbeth Salander becomes a bigger character in the next couple stories. And whatever his name is, character kind of doesn't diminish Blomqvist. A little bit.
Kalle Blomqvist
or whatever. That he doesn't become as major a character, so it'll be interesting to see how that plays out.
Yep, I agree. All right, so next up in line is one of our special guests, and that is Pete Bastian. Pete, what was your pick?
My pick, I thought long and hard about it, and this guy, this role, I should say, has been played by at least one, maybe a couple other people. Actually, now that I think about the recent TV show, a couple people at this point, but in my mind, there will only be one Hannibal Lecter ever, and that's Anthony Hopkins.
Mm-hmm. Excellent.
Nice one.
Yeah. Have you seen Manhunter, Pete?
I've seen a bit of it, but the soundtrack is so god-awful that I never managed to sit through the whole thing.
Interesting.
Well, it came out in 1986, so yeah, it's a little dated in that respect, but I do think it's far superior to Red Dragon. Overall,
Red Dragon, yeah. the Edward Norton one.
Yeah,
it's the same story, just different.
It's the exact same times movie. Yeah.
Yeah, I just did not like that one at all.
Red Dragon.
Yeah, I couldn't get into it at all.
Yeah, Pete, I think you're right on with this. I think, yeah, he is. I mean, that essentially, I mean, think about how long Anthony Hopkins had been around as an actor in many circles. I mean, more in the kind of traditional British Shakespearean way, but, you know, someone who had established himself in a big way as an actor, for all of a sudden to have him be, you know, the serial killer guy. I mean, that means that he had to turn in a hell of a performance for that. And he most certainly did. What was it about the performance that you saw him do better than anyone else could? What part of it made it truly his performance?
Well, I mean, the characterization. First of all, when I first saw that movie as a kid, and yes, I saw it as a kid when I was unsupervised one night, which probably has something to do with my choice here. But I'd never seen Anthony Hopkins before. I'd never seen him in anything because I guess looking back, he was, you know, from the research I've done, he was mostly a stage actor. And he was in like a few smaller roles, but I'd never seen him before. So he was just a completely new person to me. And he just inhabited the whole role. I mean, I'd never seen him before, so as a fresh person to me, he was Hannibal Lecter. That was him. And his characterization, just like the mannerisms, the cadence of the way he spoke, just I mean, he's not even on screen for that, for, you know, any sort of significant portion of the screen time of the film, and he's still the thing that everybody remembers about the entire movie.
He is that film.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, and to give Pete's argument a little more weight, when Red Dragon was made, there are a lot more scenes with Hannibal Lecter in them than there are in Manhunter. So, and that to me was because of Anthony Hopkins.
Yeah, I think that was a large criticism of Hannibal. You know, the book Hannibal was not great, but it wasn't bad. But then, it, you know, they essentially just like they tried to do what we talk about in remaking movies, which is take which came before and ratchet it up a little bit. But they did so in a way that was just like kind of silly. Like Hannibal Lecter was he was not human, you know, like in Silence of the Lambs, he's almost inhuman, but yet he remains human. Whereas in Hannibal, for example, he is not. I mean, he's just like a caricature of Hannibal Lecter. But in Silence of the Lambs, and that's nothing to do with his performance, that's all in the writing. But in Silence of the Lambs, you could understand, you know, sort of why he was the way he was. Like you felt a strange empathy for someone who ate people. he ate them, and you're like, all right, I get that. Okay, that yeah, all right, okay, I can see that.
So perversively likable. It's just
he's so good at what he does.
Well, and there's just such a great calculation to everything that he does, like you said before, just even the way that he speaks and his cadence, and he can simultaneously make you like him and be so completely cold and evil at the same time.
Well, and I think there's something about someone with really good manners that they're allowed to pass in a lot of ways. And so I know I identified with that in the movie, and I remember thinking how creepy it was that someone who could do that had such great manners.
Oh, he's a gentleman.
Yeah, he was so impeccable.
Excuse me for jumping out of this conversation, but I'm having an old friend for dinner.
Nice. Hope he brought the Chianti.
We can't hang out again, Josh. I can't do it.
Do you want to come over for dinner? No. Why? No.
Only in public places that are well lit and full of people.
Nice. Yeah, that's a good one, Pete. I think that's right on. All right, moving on to the next pick, our old stalwart Lee Halfspin. Lee, what was your choice?
Well, mine is a really good example of how someone who's miscast can be perfect for a role. And it's one of the earliest coming of age movies. And mine is Dustin Hoffman in The Graduate.
Ooh,
nice.
So and the reason I picked him is because the role is so, he is so the opposite of how the role was written. It was written as like this tall, blonde haired surfer guy from California, and he is the exact opposite of that. And short. Yet he makes it all, yep, short, stumpy, dark hair, not very athletic, and yet he's so perfect in that role, because he plays that nervous, amiable personality so well, and his humor is so dry that, you know, it's almost like he's being funny, but he's just not trying to be funny. And, you know, the first time I saw this, I was in college, and I was like, yeah, that's one of the best casting choices ever. Like, I thought of it even back then.
He was, I mean, the perfect voice for that character. I mean, he's an excellent actor, but I think it was largely just that he was the right person for that personality, that dialogue, that everything about that character. And because of it, it's now one of the most well-known performances ever. So,
yeah. Right. Yeah, like I said, it's miscasting that worked out really, really well.
That's really interesting to look at it that way. I wonder, I would love to think of that more thoroughly, like other casting choices that went against type or went against as written and ended up succeeding largely because of the difference in that. That's really interesting.
Like Anthony Daniels.
Hopkins?
No, Anthony Daniels,
C-3PO. Anthony Daniels. Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know, that one?
Yeah. Oh, God. Yeah,
Anthony. Failure. Sorry.
Hand failures. In your card.
I'm sorry.
Well, that's
worse than Han Solo was a bounty hunter.
Almost.
but that brings up the point too that that I made to Kyle before that he references is there a certain point where it's the actor is so good for a character that's unknown? Like in comparison to how the conversation with all of this originally started was Pete saying that Hugh Jackman was the absolute perfect choice and there was no better casting that's ever been made for a person playing Wolverine. So the question eventually becomes is in that case, you know, it's a story that's not known. And it was a script that was written versus, say, an adaptation of a book or a novel or a graphic novel. And does that person ultimately become the character, or can you not think of the character in any different way? And are you so drawn into it because of that perfect choice of the actor? And I think that's where this can get so interesting. Yeah, you know, it's like Kevin Smith is a great example as Silent Bob. You know, he wrote right. the movies. But who could you honestly take as anyone better than Silent Bob? Or even, you know, when you think about it, I mean, you go through that entire series. You know, Jay, as an example, could you go anyone beyond Jason Mewes? So ultimately, it gets to a point where the actor really does set the framework for how you see it.
Right.
That was one of the things that I was thinking about when we first posed the question was, the people that came to mind or the roles that came to mind first were from books or graphic novels or something where you had a preconceived notion of what this character looked like, how they acted. And then when, for better or for worse, when it became a movie and you saw the character, you're like, that's exactly how I pictured it. Or, God, they did not get that right at all. And then, you know, that becomes a perfect casting choice because they nailed what you expected them to be like based on what you already knew, as opposed to somebody creating a role or creating a role that was not even supposed to be like they created it and inhabiting that and making that so perfect.
Well, and I think if they had cast this movie the way I think the producers wanted them to with like Robert Redford or someone like that, I don't think it would have worked as well because I don't, you know, Dustin Hoffman, he looks like such an underdog. And that's kind of what his character is throughout. I mean, he's experienced a lot of success just out of pressure from his parents, but he's very much an underdog. So I don't know if that would have worked as well with a 6 foot tall, blonde haired surfer from California.
Nobody cool works in that role. Nobody that's cool right. works in that role.
Yeah, exactly. That's very well put.
But moving on, Kate is up next.
I thought about it a lot, and I thought of a number of casts that I liked, ensembles, and then I landed on someone who I had a girl crush on for a long time. But then I was right out of high school, or a couple of years past high school, and she landed this role that was sort of unlike her, and it was Annette Bening as Carolyn Burnham in American Beauty.
Ooh, yeah. Excellent.
Yeah, I just
solid.
Yeah, I'd thanks. I'd always loved her and the movie she did kind of running up to this, let's see, like American President, Mars Attacks, Bugsy. You know, I always sort of loved her spirit and this is, you know, in those like years after college when you're really, I knew I loved movies. I've always had a love affair with movies, but when you're really kind of defining who you are and what you're going to do. And I just totally fell in love with this film and her role in it, sort of that woman on the edge and keeping it together. And also the fact that it was something that she hadn't really done before. And I love that so late in her life and so late in her career. So I was really inspired by it. And the more I thought about it, too, the more I thought that this really is a killer ensemble and sort of the perfectly cast movie all around. I mean, just like Peter Gallagher as, you know, the always too much real estate agent and Mina Savari as the, you know, like pretty but attainable, you know, slightly broken cheerleader. And so... Yeah, but I started with
Kevin
her.
Spacey. Don't ever forget to mention Kevin Spacey.
Well, that goes without saying. He is just so
never
brilliant.
Sleep on Spacey. Never sleep on Spacey.
Never. The scene
it's
in
a good
the garage.
Rule of thumb for all of us.
Kate, yeah. I think you do a great point in picking a cast on that. It's kind of like American History X, Ed Norton and the entire cast and crew. Such a perfect all the way through.
Yep.
Yeah. Allison Janney, I sort of had forgotten about that, about her role as the submissive wife to Chris Cooper.
Oh, yeah.
As the Fitz.
Good call.
Yeah, Colonel Fitz and his wife, Barbara. And I realize I don't think her name is ever even mentioned, which is just perfect, too, because of her role.
Yeah.
And she's just such a great actress to begin with, and then to be in a role that you really don't. It's not one of the major players in that, but it becomes one because of how she plays it, and she just it's so solid.
That scene on the couch where they're sitting kind of in a row, and she's in her white nightgown and just looking off, and nobody's talking. She goes, "Oh, I'm sorry. What?" And and the son goes, "Mom, no one said anything." And then she apologizes again. It's just like, it just captured that entire thing. So I like the women in this movie. I like the way they were cast. I like the rest of the cast a lot. But it started with her, Annette Bening, and that woman on the edge role.
That's right on. I love that.
Yeah.
I also, I could say the same thing for The Grifters, which speaks to her talent as an actress. That is one of my favorite movies, and kind of came out of nowhere for me. That is one of those shock endings, and I won't give it away. But if you haven't seen The Grifters, go rent it / Netflix it / whatever right now. It is extraordinarily good, and the ending will stick with you. It's really good.
Yeah, I saw a lot of The Grifters role in this too.
Yep. Yeah, she is a really strong actress, and I love that she. You know, she does roles when she wants to. And, you know, it's not like she takes stuff that's crap. Like if she does something, it's darn well going to be something really, really good. And in this case, it was really, really good. So, yeah, I admire her as an actress a lot.
Yeah, I think they have four kids. So I know she's been staying home with them in between and doing all of the mom stuff in between taking roles. I read a little bit about her bio.
Cool.
Yeah.
Nice. Any other thoughts on Annette Bening in American Beauty? All right, right on. Moving on to Jeremy Nilsson. What is your pick?
Well, I've been tossing around several all day and for the last few days. And like I said earlier, I was trying to avoid taking a role that was based on movie or a TV or a book or a comic book or something that we've already had a preconceived notion of what that character is and what they're like. And trying to find something that's kind of brand new or created by the movie itself. And so I ended up with a pick that's kind of similar to what Kyle said, where in my opinion, the movie doesn't work without this role and without this role doing well. It still would have been a fine movie, I'm sure, but it would not have been what it was. And so I went with George Clooney as Everett McGill.
Oh, nice.
It's awesome.
That great casting choice.
From Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? For those that don't know the Coen brothers.
Mm-hmm. Very good.
Yeah, that's one you could pick almost anybody from. I mean, there are so many indelible names and just characters that, you know, kind of speak to who they are as an actor. Like John Goodman. I mean, he's played that similar type of role in many movies, but yeah.
What made me land on that one finally is that I've never liked George Clooney, and I like him in this role. And I can't picture anybody else playing that suave but stupid, very well, articulate, dirty, goofy. He embraces all of the different pieces of that role, and it just works the way that he pulls it off. And I cannot picture a single other person making that mix come off the way that he did.
I went into that thinking that it wasn't going to be believable, but. He surprised me a lot, and I was like, "Wow, I'm not seeing any of the other cool characters that he's played." So, yeah, I like that a lot.
That speaks volumes because he's played a lot of incredibly, incredibly cool characters. So, yeah, that's
you sold your soul to the devil at the crossroads for that one. Good call,
Jer. Is it just because you've been jealous of George Clooney this whole time?
I've been jealous of his mustache.
Haven't we all?
Good answer. Good answer. Would you consider yourself a Dapper Dan man, Jer?
Are you a fop man?
Indubitably a Dapper Dan man.
Can I suggest an alternate casting choice just to cement how good George Clooney is in that role?
Please do.
You can.
Christian Slater.
Okay, okay.
Thanks.
Happy Hard Harry's.
I am bona fide. It'd be just young Jack Nicholson doing inexplicably doing Oh Brother Where Art Thou.
And Winona Ryder in the wife role.
Oof. Hmm. Who was the wife in the movie? I don't remember.
Holly Hunter.
Oh, of course, yes.
Who shines in a very small role.
Excellent, mm-hmm. excellent movie. Just mm-hmm. all around, such a great movie.
You know, it's interesting. I could think of several people who could play this, but none who should. And I wouldn't want to see it changed because of that. Like, I think a lot of people could have done that. I mean, even just thinking back, like, you know, Billy Bob Thornton could have tried it, but I think he would have been too bumbling. And Clooney, like, balanced the bumbling and the sweet and the genuine and the interesting. And yeah, he kind of captured everything, which is pretty, pretty impressive. That's
he did the fast talking so well. I can't picture anyone else doing that. That fast, rapid-fire cadence mm-hmm. of his with the same effect.
The only criticism
Vince Vaughn, maybe. Vince Vaughn could do the fast talking, but he couldn't pull off the accent and the kind of the acceptance and understanding of everything that was happening around
him. Yeah, he would channel his Swingers character too much, I think.
Yeah, I would expect like a knowing look into the camera with like an eyebrow raise kind of thing at some points if it was him, but yeah. Right on. All right. Moving on. Next is Josh Freeman. Josh, what was your pick?
Well, I thought about this one as everybody did tough. And when I went back to the original conversation that kind of sparked a lot of this, and there's so many different ways it could go. And I could talk about, you know, the people who played the Joker throughout the years and how I could use each of them, even though there were three different people in the Batman series, as saying they were perfect based on the Joker that time. However, the thing that really stuck out to me as I thought about adaptation, I thought about a person who was so perfectly cast, someone who always sticks out in my mind because of his history, because of who he was, the fact that he grew up as a boxer, the fact that he had a deformed face, the fact that he did get into drinking troubles, did have spousal abuse. I actually chose Mickey Rourke as Marv in Sin City.
Ooh.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
Nice.
And kind of not a career redefining role, because I think that happened sort of doubly for him with The Wrestler and this role. Again, both of which you could say almost the same things about, you know, I mean, you could call it typecast, but oftentimes when you're saying that, you're just saying perfectly cast, you know, and I think that is absolutely the perfect thing for that role. Absolutely.
Well, this was kind of his foray back into movies because he had taken time away. I mean, he was a junior, he was a Golden Glove and junior boxer and had done quite well and then stopped for a number of years and had went on to acting and had all these kind of, you know, the small roles he had in the 80s and everything. And then he took time away and became a professional boxer. And after 8 bouts, he needed to have major facial reconstructive surgery and decided to quit boxing. So he comes back, he does kind of these menial roles, and then he gets a role that he gets to shine in and really kind of show himself. Following that, then what happens? Now you've got The Wrestler coming afterwards. And he was up in for Sin City, like for Marv, he was noted by a bunch of critics as one of the standout pieces of a character who was played. And then following up with that, as I said, he does The Wrestler, and then he gets the Golden Globe nominations and everything else. And it's kind of like, wow, this is a guy who he gets it. He plays that character well. He plays that troubled soul of somebody who had an opportunity and then lost it in real life, or took a different path and then had to come back to it. He was a fighter, and he does it, and he plays it so well. And it's just it just fits in perfectly with the theme of who Marv is in that entire movie and his storyline about going out and finding the killer of Blondie and ultimately having to bludgeon the person with his fists. So
yeah,
so much gain, so much lost.
Yeah, it's and he, I mean, that's a there are not many lovable characters in Sin City, and that's kind of the point. You know, he brings heart to that role. I mean, I think Marv is a character you want to root for because he's, you know, he's after a good cause, if you will. I mean, I think revenge and redemption is a big factor. But at the same time, he's a total dick in a lot of ways. So it's like, you know, he's not lovable in that way, but you really wanted to root for him in that role. And so much of that is his performance in doing that.
Yeah, that's my choice, and that's how I'm sticking to it.
Well done.
I say as an 80s baby and 90s kid, my knowledge of Mickey Rourke, there's a huge gap that ends at 9.5 weeks and starts again at Sin City.
Same here.
That was his professional boxing career, and when he had to take time off because of multiple facial surgeries.
He also nearly drank himself to death a few times, right, too. He had that going for him.
Yeah, multiple DUIs, domestic abuse, assault charges, all things that he's come back for, and he's turned that into, you know, being able to turn that around into his characters, which is why it stuck out for me as this makes sense.
Yep, that's right. Excellent. On. Good pick, Josh. All right, and finally, our stalwart, Andy Wicks. Andy, what was your pick?
So this whole episode revolves around the perfect perfect actor for the perfect role, which in my mind brings to mind stereotypes. Stereotypes are stereotypes for a reason, because they fit the description of whatever they are stereotyping so well that they become that epitome of that role. So I picked the cast of James Earl Jones as the voice of Darth Vader as my perfect casting choice.
Excellent.
Now this is, I'll qualify that by saying, yes, I know I recast Darth Vader in our Star Wars episode not too long ago. I didn't enjoy doing it, and I still think that James Earl Jones would be better than Brian Blessed. As much as I love Brian Blessed, he's not James Earl Jones. And also, I think to say that James Earl Jones was the perfect choice for this role, there needs to be a lot of credit given to Ben Burtt, the sound, one of the main sound designers for Star Wars, for making his voice, giving it that little extra edge that made it so memorable. But really, James Earl Jones did provide the timbre, the cadence, the diction, the delivery of the lines to go with the physical presence of David Prowse, that he became the standard of movie villains that we have used essentially since 1977. So for that reason, in my mind, he was the perfect choice for that role and as Darth Vader.
Yeah.
Well, it's a great point too, because you hit on the timbre and the voice, and you can't not hear anything he does now or see him. And as soon as he speaks, you can't stop, sit attentive, and listen.
Yeah, exactly.
Because he's just got a voice that just pulls you in.
I think that.
And you hear it as Darth Vader.
Yeah, exactly.
I always hear it as Darth Vader talking, but still. And it's kind of like when he goes off in his monologue in Field of Dreams. You can't not just stop and just look at the brilliance of it and listen to him when he's talking to Rey about, you know, there's something else beyond out there. It pulls you in, and you're just like, okay, whatever else is happening around me right now, my house is burning. Stop a minute, because James Earl Jones is speaking.
Exactly. even when I first saw The Lion King, every time I heard him speak as whatever his character's name was.
Mufasa.
Yes, thank you. Mufasa.
Nice work.
All I could think of was Darth Vader. Like, I was expecting Mufasa to force choke somebody. So that to me, I think, just shows the power of his performance in those movies. So
there's a line in Coming to America where he talks about, like, you know, don't tell my son that I'm here. He says, do not alert him to my presence. And I was like, that's Darth Vader.
That's right. I forgot about that.
Simba.
Good point.
I am your father.
Have you ever seen behind the scenes footage from any of the Star Wars movies where they actually had the actor who physically portrayed Darth Vader?
Yeah, like David
Prowse. His lines.
Yes.
Oh my God, it's hilarious. It's like, you are part of the Rebel Alliance and a traitor. Take her away. I mean, it's just so, like, twee. It's hilarious.
And it literally just sounds like someone holding their hand in front of their mouth and talking like this.
Yes, yeah.
And but he thought he was actually going to be the voice.
Yeah, I love that.
Until he saw the movie, he was like, he thought he was the voice of Darth Vader.
Yep, that's fantastic.
Oops.
Yeah, that's a great pick, Andy. I think you are right on with that. All right, so let's go down the line here and just refresh who we all picked here. So I chose Audrey whatever from Amelie. Pete chose Anthony Hopkins from Silence of the Lambs in the role of Hannibal Lecter. Lee chose Dustin Hoffman in The Graduate. K Kate chose the ensemble cast of American Beauty, but more specifically Annette Bening. Jeremy chose George Clooney in Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? Josh chose Mickey Rourke in Sin City as Marv. And Andy chose James Earl Jones as the voice of Darth Vader in the Star Wars series. Now we're going to move on to just a quick lightning round, just because we all have so many of these that we would love to share. And I honestly, guys, if you would all be willing to come back for another one of these some way down the road, I think this would be really fun to do a part two, because I think there's probably about 15 episodes worth. We'll maybe rein that in a little bit. But yeah, so let's do a lightning round where we can share one more pick each. I'm going to go in reverse order that we did before. So, Andy Wicks, what is your lightning round choice and why did you pick it?
Two actors, actually, Chow Yun-fat and Michelle Yeoh, both and their performances in Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon.
Excellent.
Because they...
Yeah.
Am I saying why?
Amazing.
Yep, go for it.
Because they had such grace and presence throughout the entire movie, not just the fight scenes, which in and of themselves are stupendous, that to me that really showed a powerful performance by two actors, and that they were not just martial art actors, but they were truly dramatic actors and really just defined that kind of that kind of role for me. So Chow Yun-fat and Michelle Yeoh together.
Great.
Thank you.
I love that.
Chow Yun-fat in any movie where someone dives through the air with two guns in hand. Boom.
Possibly with doves flying.
Replacement killers.
Ooh, there you go.
Yeah.
All right, Josh Freeman, what is your lightning round pick?
Going with what Kate kind of did earlier, I chose a cast perspective, but wanted to focus on two people specifically as well. And I would say the entire cast of the Lord of the Rings trilogy, specifically Viggo Mortensen and Ian McKellen as Aragorn, and also as Gandalf the Grey / White. I can't think of anyone else who could pull off the flair and panache that Viggo did going through the phases of 1 through 3, all the way through Return of the King, of how he ages and how he changes personally the decisions he makes to going into a king, yet also being able to have that little bit of, I've got a little bit of cocky swagger to me, but I'm conscious enough to know it. Yet Ian McKellen carries this entire persona of who Gandalf really is and who it personifies. I can't think of two better choices from a casting perspective than those two right there.
Right on. Agreed. Yeah, I think a lot of people could do Aragorn, but none could do it anywhere near the justice that Viggo Mortensen did. I think that's right on. And Ian McKellen is Ian McKellen, for crying out loud. He is Gandalf.
He is Gandalf.
Yep. Absolutely.
Yeah, he is Gandalf.
And Magneto.
Yeah, he's a lucky guy, that one. All right, Jeremy Nilsson, what is your lightning round pick / picks is?
Well, I had two of them that I was throwing around. One of them was Ian McKellen as Gandalf. So thank you for picking that one. There will never be another Gandalf, which hopefully they're not going to try to remake those at some point. But
a sitcom with Gandalf.
It's Gandalf and Magneto, roommates.
The musical.
So my other choice outside of that one was Gene Hackman as Coach Norman Dale in Hoosiers.
Ooh.
Oh, you're brilliant. That's a good
one. Nice.
Brilliant.
It is one of the, if not the best sports movies of all time because of Gene Hackman.
Yes.
And it's,
yep.
I don't have to say anymore because I don't have anything else to say.
Nice. Good pick.
You said it all, Jer.
I think the only thing that could come close to it is maybe The Natural.
I was going to say, what is your opinion of Kurt Russell in Miracle on Ice? Or just Miracle?
Miracle? That was good. Yep. That's good.
He does embody Herb pretty good.
That's a fair point.
I loved him in Miracle on Ice.
I also
is that Disney on Ice Part 2?
I can just picture Kurt Russell skating around, and it's awesome.
In throwing around ideas for other casting choices, I did briefly think about Jack Burton as somebody that there's never going to be another Jack Burton.
Yep, Big Trouble.
Yep.
Yep. Nice. All right. Before we get too carried away here, Kate, what is your next, your lightning round pick?
I chose Alicia Silverstone as Cher in Clueless.
Ooh. Oh, my God. Yes.
Anna would love that pick.
Good call. Yep.
Perfect. Yep.
Good call.
That's Ren and Stimpy. They're way existential.
That's it. Yeah. That is, oh, man. That is perfect. Well done.
And she calls the Haitians Haitians.
Yeah. Yeah, she balanced the dits and the personality and the heart all very, very well. Yeah.
Yep.
Nice.
Rolling with the homies.
Rolling with the homies.
Moment of silence for Brittany Murphy.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, pour one out. Pour one out for Brittany.
Pour one out for Brittany.
R.I.P.
R.I.P. All right, well, on that happy note, Lee, what's your pick?
Well, mine is Jack Lemmon in The Apartment, another Billy Wilder movie. And he pretty much carries the film, he and Shirley MacLaine do. And nobody could bring the same kind of empathy that he does to that role. He's quite possibly the most likable guy in the world in that movie. And he gets stepped on a lot. Yeah, I don't think that can be recast. And I don't think, although, you know what? It's been tried. The movie Loser that came out at, I don't know, 10 years ago or something like that, was essentially a remake of The Apartment.
Interesting. I didn't know that.
Now, I recommend you watching both of them and judging for yourself. But yeah, Jack Lemmon is one of my favorite actors of all time. And especially in that role, he was the best choice for it.
Yeah.
Well, and he plays that character so well, though. I mean, he played it throughout the years. Even you can even compare it to Grumpy Old Men, you know, in comparison to Max Goldman played by Walter Matthau. You know, and Jack is kind of the one who he's a bit softer in comparison of the two.
Right.
So, good choice.
What you're saying is that someone had the audacity to cast Jason Biggs.
Yes.
To play Jack Lemmon's role in something? What?
Yes.
Oh, God. Yeah. Okay. See, I'm not going to check that out, but I will watch The Apartment again.
This is where we are as Hollywood right now.
See, I don't know if there was, if they referenced The Apartment in like the credits of Loser at all, but if you look at both storylines, they're very, very similar. The overall, like, the skeleton of the plot is the same in both movies.
Pretty nice. I'm pretty sure the high point of the movie Loser is the song Teenage Dirtbag.
Aww. Who sang that? Otis? No, what was it? Wheatus?
Wheatus, yep, that's
Wheatus.
Right. Yep.
There we go. Otis. Otis Redding on everybody. All right, Pete Bastian, what was your lightning round pick?
All right, I'm going to say, first of all, that I'm shocked that no one did this one. Michael Keaton as Beetlejuice, the ghost with the most.
Ooh, oh, man.
Nice.
Nice.
Yep. It's another one that I could see lots of people doing it, but none of them doing it well. It's a hard, hard role to do really, really well.
Yeah, he's everyone's favorite reverse exorcist. And my God, he's like, picture anyone else in that role. He's only on screen for like 10 or so minutes and irreplaceable. It's impossible to think of anyone else in that place.
Good call.
Nice.
Yeah, that's right on. All right, and I'll finish up here. So my choice is, it is one actor in one movie, but it is three roles, and that is Peter Sellers in Dr. Strangelove. He plays Dr. Strangelove, the titular character. He plays a general, and then he plays, what's the third one?
The president.
The president, yeah, Merkin Muffley, yep. And interestingly, he was originally... His name is Merkin Muffley.
I never caught that.
Yeah, yeah. So originally he was set to play the role of the bomber pilot that Slim Pickens eventually played, but he didn't feel like he could do the kind of cowboy accent well. So he almost was a fourth character, and thank God he didn't do that, because Slim Pickens is just a revelation in that movie. I mean, he is astoundingly good. But yeah, Peter Sellers. I would throw out just a shout out to the Pink Panther movies too. Mm-hmm. Him as Inspector Clouseau is just, I mean, their two roles are meant to be together, but just just what Peter Sellers did in that movie is extraordinary. In three very different roles, he owned them all equally well. And, you know, I don't think that movie, again, could be what it was without what Peter Sellers did. And it's probably my favorite comedy of all time, largely because of his performance. So I just love those to death. Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room. It's just so much goodness. All right. So I did put a call out to Facebook, and Jared did to Twitter as well. So I'm going to go through some Facebook picks here. We got just a ton of them, and I'll pick a couple here that were some of my favorites. Jim Gillison suggested Jeff Goldblum as Dr. Ian Malcolm in Jurassic Park. Kyle Hoff, either seriously or cheekily, I can't tell which, suggested Brett Favre as Brett Favre in Something About Mary.
It is perfect.
Yeah, Bridget Gare suggested Michael Cera as Scott Pilgrim. Allison Clotter suggested Christopher Lloyd as Doc Brown, which I think is awesome.
Great, great pick.
Yep. Emily Allen suggested Sean Connery as Indiana Jones's father. I think that's right on. Let's see here. What else? Oh, Becca Alhorn Ralstad suggested Jason Schwartzman in Rushmore and Andre the Giant in Princess Bride.
That's perfect.
That's maybe my favorite so far. I think I'm going to end with that. Andre the Giant and Princess Bride. Aww. Man, that's, aww, Andre. Yeah, that's just too awesome. So thanks to that. And then Jerry, you called it out to Twitter as well. Do you want to give a couple bits of feedback that people provided from that?
Sure. We've got four of them. Kyle Herbert, who is at Kyle D. Hebert. @KyleDHebert. Said Gregory Peck as Atticus Finch in To Kill a Mockingbird.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's yeah. on. That's perfect.
Excellent.
Becca Williams at @BEJOGram at... sorry, I cannot do Twitter, apparently.
It's okay.
@BEJOGram said Anthony Hopkins as Hannibal.
Yeah.
Yep, good call.
And then I've got... That one was correct. Chelsea, who is at Slay Chels... said Michael Jordan as Michael Jordan in Space Jam.
But not Larry Bird? What's up with that? What? That's weird.
Muggsy Bogues? What?
I don't know.
Oh, Space wow. Jam. Oh, man. Muggsy Bogues. I'm going to create a gangster movie called Muggsy Bogues.
Nice. Finally, Matt Bowen, who is at @MW_MattBoy, said Kevin Spacey as Verbal Kent.
Yeah.
Yep.
Can't argue with that. Nice. All right. Well,
we've already recast him.
Yeah, that's all right. I agree that it's hard to recast, but we did our darndest. Who did we pick for that one? Sam Rockwell?
No, Jackie Earl Haley.
Jackie Earl Haley. Yeah, no. We did good on that one. Good work, crew. Nice.
Kind of surprised no one mentioned John Cusack as Lloyd Dobler tonight. Oh,
save it for part two. Hold
I
up.
Know.
I'm so excited for more of these. This makes me so happy. I'm glee clapping gently here. I can't do it loud because I'm next to a microphone.
Super proud that we didn't do superheroes. I mean, like, superheroes are the easiest pick, and there was, like, none of them. I expected a glut of superhero picks.
Oh, that should be a special episode.
Part two. Yep. Yeah, yeah. That was kind of what this was spawned off of initially, yeah. So that could be something in its own.
I think maybe we were a little afraid to do that in fearing that everyone would do that, so now we can maybe rein that in a little.
Yes.
Pick it. Yeah, I like it. Nice. Well, again, if you want to find out more information about Remakers Mark or any of the blogs and podcasts as part of the Math is Hard Network, check us out at mathishard.net. Again, you can find us on Twitter or Facebook under username mathishardnet. Gentlemen and lady, this has been a wonderful time. I am seriously excited about this and can't wait to have more guest hosts on Remakers Mark, have more special episodes, and to talk with this more specifically with you all. So thank you very much. It's been a real joy. We have a traditional closing here. We're a fairly non-denominational church here at Remakers Mark, but I just want to say to you all from the bottom of my heart, may the force be with you.
And also with you.